Okay.
So I have a phrase that I've heard at least once, maybe a few times during these Q&As has been something like laying a foundation. So is there, everybody's different, but is there some kind of general advice you would give to those of us who are just entering monastic practice, what to pay attention to, how to lay a good foundation?
Let's see. Yeah, I mean, one is recognizing that our practice grows and develops dependent on the foundation that we lay, so that it in terms of the fundamentals of our relationship to precepts and training and rules, or our perspectives on right view, and having a fundamental framework that is really in tune with Dhamma, then our practice will grow based on that foundation. So it is important to be paying attention at laying a good foundation. And it comes down to that, in the sense of, I think that again, where so often Ajahn Chah's teachings would be about sila and samadhiti, the virtue and right view, and those are quite critical to the, because if either of those are wonky, the meditation just either doesn't grow, or it gets all pear shaped and not really bear great fruit. So that establishing a reflective investigation of, well, what does it mean to have integrity or have precepts? Because sometimes we can assume that having precepts is, we can just have more rules, and then the more rules I've got, the more precepts, the more sila I have, which is not really the case at all. It's one's relationship to sila, and in terms of, because that's like that traditional, the stock phrase that the Buddha uses in describing, say, the sila of a stream enter, in the sense of being, one's sila is not stained, not mottled, not blotched. But then it's also conducive to concentration. And so that's part of that phrase, is that sila is something that we're helps to support the settling of the mind, and so not sort of relating to precepts from a fear-based foundation or even a greed-based, in terms of, if I just get more precepts, then I'll be more pure. And it has a certain logic to it, but it doesn't really fit with Dhamma. And so that it's, what is it that helps to create a sense of clarity and well-being that allows us to free the heart from dukkha. So that's where that sila, working with samadhiti, with right view, and just like that. It's like when your fundamental definition of right view is say on a transcendent level is the Four Noble Truths, and so that one is viewing experience through the lens of dukkha and cessation of dukkha, as opposed to viewing experience through the lens of me here inside, with my sense of self, and the world outside, which I'm either trying to manipulate to fulfill me or to run away from because I don't like it or feel overwhelmed by it. So it's an experiential basis of how we view experience. But then also on a mundane level, right view is fundamentally just understanding and recognizing karma and its fruit. That whole lengthy definition of how the Buddha describes mundane right view is all around the action and result of action, and so that understanding. Yeah, we're definitely the owners of our karma, heirs to our karma, born of our karma, related to our karma, abide supported by our karma, and it's taking responsibility for that. So I think another aspect in terms of laying a foundation for the holy life is there's a couple of things, you know, within that sense of sila and samadhi, and you know, because then you're really nourishing the aspiration for peace and wisdom, which is our using the meditation to take us to that goal of peace, internal peace, tranquility, clarity, and wisdom, understanding, discernment, and so but then also in terms of laying a foundation, that approaching the holy life from a perspective of giving to it, because so often we're conditioned to think in terms of, you know, what can I get out of this, and what can I get out of these people, and it's a miserable mental state to have to be in, and that ability to give of oneself to the training, to the community, to the people that one lives with, that lays a very strong foundation for being happy in the holy life. Because if one is living the monastic life with that, constantly having that ledger out and trying to figure out what one's getting out of it, you're going to be miserable. Doesn't matter, because it's desire functions on every single level of our being, and it doesn't matter how much knowledge or how much we've been given or how peaceful our mind becomes. There's always something more, and the mind can get, and it can get more peaceful. Or we can get more knowledge, or we can get more understanding, or we can get more benefit in some sort of way, shape, or form. But it's not a happy way to live. It's exactly why we're dissatisfied with the world already. So that approaching living the monastic life from a place of giving oneself to it and giving oneself to the community and making an effort to to be harmonious, to learn how to get along with people. I've been here for a long time, and I've been a monk for a long time, and I've lived in community for a long time. And I could go down the line and find fault with every single person. But I'm not dumb. But it's a pathetic way to live. And so that learning how to live in a harmonious way, in a skillful way, and that's really helpful foundation for it. Because you want to be able to live the holy life and the monastic life, a life of spiritual training, in a way that actually makes you happy. And the thing is if that happiness comes from some kind of sensory gratification or some kind of distraction, it doesn't actually make you happy. It's amissa sukha and nilamissa sukha. So the Buddha points to these two kinds of happiness, and amissa sukha is, amissa is usually translated as sort of worldly or like pleasure of the flesh, because it actually does mean flesh, but it's kind of like it's the bait. It's that bait that is on the hook that fish go to. It's the bait that's in a trap that, of course, you put out for the rats and the mice, and then we ship them off, which is pretty benign compared to what other people do with them. But it's that happiness with a bait. So it's so that niramissa sukha, that non-material happiness, that non-worldly happiness, isn't kind of say non-worldly in the sense of kind of space cadet, totally out of it, but grounded and steeped in well-being, based on the fruits of incredibly skillful life. And it's, those are some aspects. And part of it as well would be around the recognition that we're... In the same way that I'm thinking back of living the life with a sense of giving oneself to the training, giving oneself to the life, and also recognizing that we are here on a day-to-day basis because of the gifts of others, and sometimes it's easy to forget that, or to overlook it sometimes because on a certain level, our standard of living is actually far more comfortable than a lot of people in the world, certainly more secure, even though we're quote unquote homeless, and that is it because of the generosity and kindness of so many people. And so it's important to be living a standard of practice that one is not taking any of that for granted, and being willing to give oneself to the training so that it can be a source of of encouragement and inspiration to others, because they give so much to look after us. So those are some thoughts.
Well, would you be willing to speak on the importance of contemplating or having faith in rebirth or nirvana?
Well, I mean, it's not something you can mandate, and it isn't something you can say, "Oh, you've got to have that as a condition." And especially in a Western culture where it's not the norm, doesn't mean it's not. I mean, I think it, you know, for me, it's just part and parcel of right view, and it is in the description of there is this world, there is another world. I mean, it's part of the description of mundane right view. But it's not something you can mandate, and in something like Ajahn Chah he never made a big deal of it, because I think the Buddha's teachings stand on their own without expecting or forcing people to believe it. The reality of this is when one starts to contemplate in that way and start investigating it, and the mind has a deeper understanding and acceptance of that worldview, then faith is a lot more solid, it's a lot more stable, and I think the motivation to practice is more stable as well, or more oomph behind it. You think it's, especially when you think, God, this lifetime has been bad enough, I have to keep doing this, you know. So I mean, it's really a motivator.
Could I ask the angle that you were speaking about forcing people or mandating it?
Yeah.
What are you speaking to? And sort of, I guess, are you hearing something in my question, or it is like in the past that people tried to do that, or what? Like,
yeah. 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 I mean, it's definitely. I mean, there are places and teachers that is I mean, they pound away on it, and you know, especially for Western, it turns them off. Because you can't. I mean, it's something you have to accept on faith. But for me, it's not. It's just the way the world works, and have enough. I haven't seen my own past lives, but I've had enough kind of insights that, you know, okay, so there's a lot more going on, and I've been in contact with so many people who I trust, who have. To speak with authority about their own experiences, both monastic and lay people who talk about those aspects of their experience. So to me, I don't have a difficulty or problem accepting. It's just to me, it makes complete sense. And recognizing that the mind how hard it is to slow it down, let alone stop it, and that impetus and that seeking a being just you don't flip the switch and it's done just because you die. It's seeking. It'll manifest anywhere, however it can.
So it sounds like those, the teachings on that, the teachers speaking about their experiences about that, it's out there. And if people pick it up or not, you sort of leave it up to them.
Yeah, I leave it up to them. Or if people ask, then I tend to speak from my perspective and my own experience. But I don't base what I teach and what I expect people to follow as a teaching on that. Because it's... And I recognize that. I saw that with Lobo Chow, where he's just accepting something only on faith is not a good foundation for confidence. So you want to build, you want to try to get people to build their confidence in the practice, in the things that they can experience and see, and then that again that lays a foundation for perspectives that would be you wouldn't even have considered before.
It kind of leads to my last question, which for the community actually kind of ties in with the very beginning. We had a chance to have a video conference with Tanajana Nun, and he gave the community lots of really wonderful advice. And one of the things that I remember was he said, during this period of retreat, don't forget the goal, don't forget Nibbana.
Yeah.
So I was thinking about, like, you know, that's been a theme for me, and also thinking about, like, okay, you know, sometimes Nibbana can be either sort of distant or inscrutable, you know, and in the day-to-day trenches of monastic life, you know, how do we orient ourselves towards Nibbana? What, you know?
I think one is just like what comes up in several suttas, the Giri Mananda Sutta, both as the reflection on, because it's on recollections, so it's both the recollection for viraga, dispassion, as well as nirodha, which is a synonym for cessation of dukkha or nibbana. But that, yeah, this is peaceful, this is sublime. They can't remember the ending of all substrata, the ceasing of cessation, nibbana, this is peaceful, this is sublime, this is something that's really worth lifting the heart up to, and realizing that there is this possibility in our human existence and our practice to plug into, to tap into this cessation of dukkha, and in doing that, then we really encourage ourselves. Also, looking back to the kind of the roots of the word Nibbana, that sense of cooling is a real it had a mundane sense before the Buddha started using it with an exalted sense, so that you know, the uh, And you take the rice off the pot of rice off the fire, and you set it off to the side to let it nibbana, you know, to cool down, and that's a it's important to sort of see, well, these are they're not these incredible, so it's not that far away, and the and you think of the that first glimpse of nibbana, the stream entry experience, and over and over again you see it comes up in the suttas, and what constitutes that insight or that knowledge, that recognition, is that whatever yang kinchi samudhyatam sambandham nilodatam, whatever is of the nature to rise, that is of the nature to cease. And so that seeing of that, both the conditionality as well as that pattern. There's the how do you say, the corollaries of that, or the result of that, of course, in dispassion, relinquishment. So that approaching these the teachings and the perspectives of the goal, and realizing that one, I mean, it's incredibly worthy, and two, it's not beyond our capability or means to be able to experience that.
I was hooked in one section. It's about like desire and consumerism, society, and one of the writings is about the desire to know things, like science, we want to know how nature works, or kind of manipulate it, or something like that. I'm wondering how that ties into practice, because there is that aspect of like gaining insight into things. Mm-hmm. And of course doesn't have to be like, I need to know impermanence, I need to totally understand this impermanence thing, but I wonder how does that desire to know work in practice?
Well, that's a motivating factor for practice. Because I want to know how dukkha and cessation of dukkha works. I want to understand how this practice does work, there's a stock set of teachings that the Buddha gives, the wings to awakening, 37 Bodhipakkhya Dhammas. And there are different sets of teachings that the Buddha has given. One of those sets of teachings is what's called the four bases of success. Four bases of psychic powers, four bases of success, iddhipadas. And the first one is desire. But it's chanda. As opposed to like tanha is desire, that by definition, tanha is desire that is associated with greed, hatred, delusion. We're always going to lead to suffering in some way, shape, or form. Chanda is desire, and it can go both ways. It usually has a qualifier if it's going to go in a negative, but like kama chanda is the first nivarana or hindrance. So okay, that goes to suffering. But generally, chanda as a desire, a wholesome desire, because there's like dhamma chanda, the desire for truth, desire for dhamma, kusala chanda, desire for the wholesome, or desire in this in these idipadas is a motivation, is a wholesome motivation to be, because it results in, say, those four bases of success, the four dhammas. So chanda, wirya, jitta, vimamsa, so the chanda, desire, wirya, effort. If there's desire and then no effort, then it's not going to lead to much. But then wirya, jitta is then establishing the mind, settling the mind. And vimamsa is investigation. And it has a particular connotation of reviewing. So that one reviews experience, reviewing, reflecting, so investigation. So those are desire, effort, settling the mind, reflecting, investigating. Usually what will come up would be more motivation, more desire, in the sense of, oh yeah, well that's a really important thing. So that's a desire is an essential piece of the. There's also this is a sutta where Ananda, I think it's in the Samyutta Nikaya, where Ananda speaks about desire leading to like there's. You know, leading to the end of desire. It's a sutta in the...
Going to the park?
Yeah. One going to the park, getting into this bit of a debate, and then the wanderer sort of take him to task because, this path doesn't have an end. And said, well, there's desire that leads to the end of desire. And, wanting to experience peace and wisdom and liberation, then one doesn't do anything. And that's not the end of suffering.
One more.
Yeah.
With the idipadas, I was just wondering, I guess I haven't come across too many places where they're discussing the suttas, but would it be correct to kind of like understand their kind of place in the framework is kind of ways, or they kind of apply to like samasati and samasamadhi, kind of the way that we try to cultivate samadhi, and just how do we develop and kind of reviewing and putting effort and these sort of things.
Yeah, and they're oftentimes in the suttas the most often. Referencing or pointing to samadhi that's cultivated with these four idipadas, chanda, wirya, jitta, vimamsa, which each factor being rooted in viveka, viraga, nirodha, vosaka. And so so it's a samadhi, and so there's samadhi and effort that are referenced in many of the suttas that use that structure of the idipadas. So you've asked all your questions.
Well, I still have more, but I cut myself off.
Yeah, well, I think everybody was very appreciative of your being proactive in making it happen. I enjoyed it. Yeah, I mean, if there are more sessions that come in the future, I think that's fine. You come up with some questions or others sort of come up with questions that they want to ask. But I think, yeah, it's been quite fruitful.
Sadhu, I'd like to thank also yourself, of course, and also the community for both sort of tolerating a shift of of gears in the retreat, and of course everybody's questions and inputs, and you know, a lot of these questions came from people, and
yeah.
And so and of course people have been discussing here, so I've been thoroughly enjoying it, so yeah, also thank you.
Yeah, great, good way to
yeah.